Open your Bibles to Mark chapter 10. Mark chapter 10. Typically, we're going verse by verse through a book. This month, I've chosen not to do that. I wanted to hit on a particular theme about living like Jesus. Last week, we looked at the heart. I'm going to do the heart, the head, the hands, and the habits. Last week, we looked at the heart. The condition of a person's heart determines the condition of their life. As Proverbs 4:23 tells us, above all else, guard your heart, for everything you do flows from it. Today I want us to look at the head, living like Jesus with my head. The way people think determines how they see, what they want, and how they respond. In Ephesians chapter 4, it says, be made new in the attitude of your minds, and be put on the new self, created to be like God in true righteousness and holiness. Next week we'll pick up the hands with this thought. What people do or don't do significantly influences their spiritual journey and how they influence others. In John chapter 13, verse 17, it says, Jesus said, now that you know these things, you will be blessed if you do them. As the book of James also indicates, it's not enough to just hear some good things, you must apply them. And the last group will pick up on habits. What people continually practice makes the difference over the long haul in their lives. Philippians 4:9, the things which you have learned, received, and heard, and seen in me, practice these things, and the God of peace will be with you. Regardless of your political persuasion or your political involvement, I know some of you have high levels of that, and some of you have very little. The question I have for us today is, why would anybody want to be president of the United States? I mean, really, it's got to be one of the most stressful positions in all the planet. Decisions about war, the economy, health care. Every decision you make doesn't just impact your family, it impacts millions of lives. Now, it's easier to sit back on a chair and criticize what a president does, regardless of which administration you might have in mind. But consider yourself in the position of president and all the decisions he has to make. I mean, who'd want to be the president and attempt to bring together two diverse views represented in Congress? Is that a fruitless activity or what? How do you get liberals and conservatives to agree on anything? How do you get conservatives to agree on anything? Let me just say that in the same room. No consensus can be very frustrating. Every president lives under constant scrutiny. Unmerciful criticism from the media, from late-night comedians. Everybody has something to say about the president. Doesn't matter which administration. Everyone evaluates your job performance every day. Anybody live under that kind of scrutiny? I don't think so. Not quite at that level. Who would want to be the president? Actually, a lot of people. I don't believe we've had in our country an election where nobody wanted to run. Some people position their lives, all of their lives, just to prepare for the opportunity to run for president of the United States. Both in the business and political world, they're getting an education, they're getting certain context, they're positioning their lives so they may have the opportunity just to be in your sights. Criticism. It's pretty amazing. Hundreds of people do this. There are basically two primary motives behind anyone who desires to be the president. I'm putting this very simply, so don't criticize me and say, well, there's really other reasons. Yes, I understand that, but why would anybody want to be the president or really have any other position of influence? Two basic primary motives, I believe. One is to contribute, to give. The desire to make a positive difference for other people's lives. It's a great motivation, very noble. I'd like to be a public servant in order to help people improve their lives. A person feels called by God or driven by a love of country to enter into the political arena or any other arena of influence and leadership. One primary motive. The second primary motive may be to consume or to get. If I had that position, look at what all the doors and opportunities it would give me. The desire to use others for your own benefit, for your own self-advancement. It's not a noble motive like the first. It's more of a selfish motive. You see people like this all the time, climbing the corporate ladder, wielding a level of power over people, and they thrive on that. You walk into a room and every eye is on you. Isn't that exciting? Our culture is absorbed with a look-at-me mentality. Would you agree? Well, we have all these reality shows and everything else on television. Look at me, look at me. Every president, politician has to determine what is their primary motive. To contribute or to consume. And we might want to judge the president or any other politician or business figure, but let us just consider our own motives for how we live our Christian life. When we do things, do we do it primarily to contribute for the benefit of others, or do we do things to consume, to get for our own advancement? Two motives compete in dominance in the head of every person, I believe, every day. Do we live and lead and love out of a desire to serve others or out of a desire to be served by others? We think our task is one of influencing people towards what is best for them and their good, or merely using people to advance our own agenda for our own good. Whether it's the President of the United States, the CEO of a company, the foreman of an assembly line, the coach of a little league baseball team, a teacher in a classroom, even a mother at home with her children, every Christian in the world must determine what motivates or to get from others. In Mark chapter 10, verse 35, we'll look at about 10 verses here, in verse 45. We have two disciples that are kind of highlighted here with motivation and desiring leadership. And it's not unworthy to desire leadership or influence, a place that you can contribute. Two of them here are highlighted. James and John came requesting positions of prominence from Jesus in His future kingdom. I believe we can learn a lot about the way Christians think how Christians think currently, and then what Jesus' response to them shows what they ought to be thinking. To live like Christ requires a shift in thinking. Look at verse 35, if you will. James and John, the two sons of Zebedee, came to Jesus saying, "Teacher, we want you to do this for us. Whatever we ask of you." Who's the servant here? Verse 36, and he said to them, "Well, what do you want me to do for you?" He's very kind, polite. They said to him, "Grant that we may sit, one on your right and one on your left, in your glory." I just want to pause just for a moment. It's not a point in the sermon, but it certainly rises to an opportunity to just notice. Notice when they asked of him, they wanted to be in a prominent position in his glory. Did they want to do this for his glory? Kind of miss that. There's a lot of people who want to be right in the front rows. If God's doing something, I want to be right there. But what is their motivation? Is it for his glory that he would be seen as preeminent, or just so they would be in a good position and everybody else could see they are something else? Hanging out with Jesus obviously draws attention. And I don't know the hearts of these two men, but I just noticed their words. All we have are the words that God has revealed. And these words obviously saying, "I know you're going to be something here really soon." And they didn't capture all of what Christ was doing. And it shows this in the text, and I'll point this out in a minute. But you're going to be something. And when that kingdom is established, when all your glory is established, we want to be in it. We want to be right there. One to the right, one to the left. Now, what are they thinking about the other 10 disciples that are following? Well, they can sit somewhere in the room, but we're going to be right there on the right and right there on the left. This is their mindset. This is the way they're thinking right now. There are basically three observations of the text. Is different kinds of thinking. The very first one, obviously, is selfish thinking. From my own study of the text, I am convinced these two men, either wrongly motivated or just misinformed, they are selfishly thinking. James and John's request shouldn't necessarily surprise us. Everyone, almost everyone, has ambitions and desires to get ahead. And they saw an open door. They saw that it was coming to the conclusion of Jesus' time here on this earth. And I believe they were thinking there's going to be an establishment of his kingdom and overthrowing the government, overthrowing the Roman rule, and Jesus would be king. And they're going to be the right and left hand men for him. They're surprised. It shouldn't surprise us that they desired to get ahead and be part of the kingdom. But selfish instincts were certainly the motivating factor, because they didn't even ask for anybody else. They didn't do it for his glory. They were just desiring to make sure they were in the right place at the right time. Selfish instincts begin when? Have any idea? 25, 30? No, right when you come out of the womb. You know, we are very needy people. Look at me, mommy. Me first. No, that's mine. It's all mine. Little children get jealous. And even newborn siblings sometimes. Why? Because they want mommy's attention completely on them. Who is this new person who just moved in? Let them take the second chair. We're very much like that. Children can be very jealous if they're not the center of attention. Even in Matthew's account of this story, it wasn't James and John that was producing this. It was their mother. Their mother went up to Jesus, or at least prodded them to, and asked, Jesus, grant that these, my sons, can sit at your side in the coming kingdom. So even mom desired for her boys to be right there in the front. Is there any mother who wouldn't want the best for their children? Certainly, you may have done this. Mothers want the best. These boys wanted the best. They wanted to move on. But what was their driving motive for doing this? It's known about Don Rickles. Anybody remember Don Rickles? If you're ever like 25, you probably know Don Rickles. All right, how many of you don't know who Don Rickles is? All right, all the children in the room, and, you know, maybe 45 and under. Don Rickles is a comedian, an older comedian. All right, you might know him best in this generation. He's Mr. Potato Head in Toy Story. So at least you know, he kind of looks like Mr. Potato Head, actually, in real life. But he has this voice. But that's who that is. You ever seen Toy Story? All right. Don Rickles, when he was unknown many, many, many years ago, he was doing small clubs as a comedian. And his mom wanted him to be better than just small clubs. And she moved to Miami and heard that Frank Sinatra's mom lived in town in Miami. So she did everything she could to position herself where she could get into a conversation with Mrs. Sinatra. And then she would go with Mrs. Sinatra to see her son sing. And says, well, now you need to come hear my son be funny. And did that a couple of times. And then she says, well, I'd like to have your son, Mrs. Sinatra, come listen to my son, and maybe he can hook him up with different people. And sure enough, Frank Sinatra was in town, and at Mama's request went to a small club to hear Don Rickles do his little comedy act. They warned Don, please don't be rude. Now, if you know Don, he can be kind of rude. All right, don't be rude towards Frank. He doesn't like that kind of thing. And in a full form, Don Rickles was all in form, and he did everything he normally does. And Frank Sinatra thought it was hilarious and hooked him up with different people, and therefore you now know Don Rickles. All because a mama worked it out for him to get a high position. Moms work that way sometimes. But there's selfish thinking in all this. Children want to be first. So do young adults. How do young people, as they grow up, they get jealous of those who get higher grades or score more points at the ball game or get more attention from the opposite sex. It all just continues to happen. Of course, when we get more mature, an adult, we don't ever have selfish thinking or motives or jealousy, yes? No, the four big B's always continue to come up. You know, the four B's, the beauty, brains, bucks, or brawn. That's all those things continue to push our philosophy and our thinking. There's a Greek philosopher, Epicurus, said, maximum pleasure, minimize pain. That's most people's philosophy. I want to maximize my pleasure, but minimize my pain. What is true about children and young adults is also true about older adults, those who consider themselves more mature. Anybody ever dealt with office politics? Position where we can maybe be seen better? How about this yard of the month crud that they do in your community? I've never had a yard of the month sign put in my yard. And I'm not jealous one bit. You can work as hard as you want to in your yard, knock yourself out. But there's competition in my neighborhood for the yard of the month. And people, they fight over this stuff. You know, who has the best Christmas lights at Christmas? Now, I might try you there, but just yard of the month stuff. How about parenting provenance? Selfish thinking. My kids are better than your kids, or my kids are just not as bad as your kids. Now, I've noticed this a little more lately. This grandparent or grandchild picture pride. You know, they bring out their pictures of their grandkids, and they have like 25 pictures, and somebody else pulls out 50 pictures to show off a little more. You know, this position, who's better? Sometimes selfish. I don't have grandkids yet, so I don't understand that. So I heard having grandkids is better than having kids. Is that true at all? Yeah, you spoil them, send them home, something like that? All right. Yeah, that's right. Selfish thinking permeates our lives. Even we can be guilty as Christian people. Who's better? Who's best? Who should be have more attention? The maneuvering just for more money or more status symbol or importance. I saw this not too long ago. A guy in Florida who's built the largest privately owned home in America named Marcellus. Have you heard of this? A 900,000 square foot, not 900, 90,000. Yeah, it's much smaller. 90,000 square foot home, largest privately owned home in Florida. He over-leveraged himself financially right before the 2008 crash, but now they're rebuilding it. I mean, they're trying to finish it now. All right, now, let me just tell you about this home. He wanted to have the largest home in America. It includes 30-car garage, 10 bathrooms, a homework room, a roller rink, 3 pools, 2 tennis courts, and a bowling alley. There's a grand ballroom with a ceiling high enough to fit a 4-story building inside. During the economic collapse, he over-leveraged himself, and he was forced to go into foreclosure. They never fully were able to sell it to anybody. In the meantime, the couple, with their 8 children, now understand, they have 8 children. We should have a parsonage like this, all right? They've been living in a much smaller home that's just not adequate. It's 2 miles down the road. Their current house only has 26,000 square feet. It only has 15 bedrooms, 4 kitchens, closets bigger than the average size apartment. Just so he can be the biggest, the best, the most attention. It's pretty amazing. I'm going to go vacation there. I'm going to call the guy. I got 8 children too. Or like this guy. True story. Another guy in his 50s was asked why he had built a 25,000 square foot house after his kids had moved out. Totally different guy. He says, well, everybody needs a little space. And in my house, my wife can't find me for days. That's unfortunate about that man, but everybody's got their own deal. All right, so James and John, I wonder, you think about these guys, and they're like, well, no, they just want to be in prominence. I wonder, though, had they even considered, James and John, they're asking Jesus, one of us wants to be on the right, one wants to be on the left. Well, which wanted to be which? Because in Jewish culture, the right hand would have been preeminent, and secondary would be left hand. Had they even discussed that in the little scheme here? There might have been a fist fight had Jesus said, okay, I'll just take James, I'll put him on the right. Who knows? There was a little selfishness continuing on. The guilty, selfish thinking. James and John came asking for positions of prominence, and their request shouldn't shock us, but because it's very typical for people. What surprises me a little bit is that they were so vocal about it. Every one of us has a selfish streak. Almost any time we get into a fight with somebody else, we have a little bit of selfishness that's involved in that. And they were just so vocal about it. Most of us are a little more subtle about our ambitions or about positions of influence. So you see in the first couple of verses, there was selfish thinking going on. That is their mindset. And Jesus says, if you're going to live like me, you've got to think differently. There has to be a shift in the way you perceive things and what you desire. So I want us to look at verse 38. You know, living like Jesus has no room for selfish thinking. Rather, we live for His glory. And He shifts the thinking, saying, no, think like me. You need to have some sober thinking first. Sober thinking. Look how he answers James, John, but Jesus said to them, you do not know what you're asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I drink, or to be baptized with the baptism which I am baptized? Now here, in the answers, I believe there are basically two principles that Jesus taught. Now you look at the number one in verse 39, are they able to do that? And they're going to say, well, yeah, we're able to drink this cup. What they did not capture from this is what he had just said to them. And here's the first principle about life. Living like Jesus is a call to die. It's not a call to preeminence, it's a call to death. Just a few verses before this, the disciples obviously had forgotten what he was saying. Verse 33 says, "Behold, we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be delivered to the chief priests and scribes, and they will condemn him to death, and will hand him over to the Gentiles. They will mock him and spit on him and scourge him and kill him. And 3 days later, he will rise again." That's where I'm heading. And you're wanting positions to my right or left. Are you sure you want to be baptized like I'm about to be baptized? I'm not talking about water baptism, about to go through this death. Are you sure you want to drink from the very cup that I'm drinking? Oh, yeah, yeah, we can do that. I don't think they fully captured what he was asking. Jesus' life involved opposition, arrest, scourging, crucifixion, and death. Is that what you're desiring? Are you willing to do that to live like me? Or do you just want positions of prominence? You know anybody who would like the big paycheck that the CEO makes, or the power the president has, but they have no desire to do anything it takes to get there? There's a lot of that going on. You know, I want to buy the house that my grandparents have now, you know, or used to have. But I want it when I'm 20 and not when I'm 65. You know, I want the big paycheck and the nice car and the debt-free life now, not sometime later. We all see a doctor who drives home in his expensive car to his big home. We say, wow, yeah, we'd like to make the money the doctors have. But we want to do the years of experience at school and late night hours and hours of study, residency, late night phone calls, frustrating failures, and not fully being able to do everything leisurely that you desire. You see a coach carried off the floor at NCAA, which was last week in Atlanta. You see the winning coach carried off, like, man, I'd like to have that attention. Look at all the world wants them, and some of them get a bigger paycheck because they get to go to a different school. Do we want that kind of attention or paycheck? Well, certainly, but do we see the late night watching of game films, the frustrating losses, and years of work? How about the rebellious athletes on their teams, or the critical fans they deal with? The CEO, you know, in our culture now, it's in vogue to rip people who make a lot of money, you know, that lead companies. How dare they get these golden parachutes? I don't care about your conviction about that. That's not my point. But say, you know, well, how come they get all this? We should just bring them down to our poor level. Wouldn't that be nice? See the marvelous salary, receiving of applause from shareholders for making the company more prosperous, working, you know, with boards and even at his local country club. He's doing well. I'd like to do that, or I'd like to bring him down if I can. Did he fail to see the sleepless nights, turning over weighty decisions, the anxiety that's put on their life, or their even their life savings at the best in their company? The critical letters, the comments from angry employees. Do we see all the picture, or do we just want the position of prominence? Were these two men asking for position of prominence because it says, we're willing to die with you? We're willing to do whatever it takes to be right at your side? Is that really what their motive is here? Even Peter said that, didn't he? I'm willing to even die for you. And at the point of the crucifixion, where was James and John and Peter and the rest of them? They right there saying, yes, take off that other thief on the cross. I want to hang up there. Was James and John on the right and left of him in this crucifixion? There's a difference here. There's sober thinking I think Christians miss. Jesus certainly tells us he loves us. And he's, you know, many of us will say, well, he has a wonderful plan for your life. But I think we're trying to find what that wonderful plan is versus God's definition of what this wonderful plan is. Sometimes we think so much on the temporary side and He has more of an eternal perspective. Might He be saying to us, I want you to live like me, and it's a call to die. Are you able to drink the cup that I drink? Jesus asked me. Life is always more difficult than you can ever imagine. A person who lives like Christ and desires to influence others must be willing to die to self. You must have an eternal perspective in mind. You can't be easily discouraged or distracted. To live like Jesus, one must be mentally tough in the face of adversity and be willing to do whatever is required for His glory. Despite the audacity of James and John, Jesus did not rebuke them directly. It indicated they did not realize the implications of their request. In the kingdom, the way to glory is through sacrifice, through service, and through suffering. In the kingdom, exaltation involves dedication to death. So he brings that first principle. It's a call to die. Look at verse 39 and verse 40 then. Living like Jesus is a call to trust. You don't know what your future holds, but someone holds the future. They said to Him, we are able. And Jesus said to them, yeah, the cup I drink, you shall drink. And you shall be baptized with the baptism which I am baptized. I'm convinced from Jesus' words there and knowing church history what happened to these men. Yes, they were going to die for Him. When He said that, I'm not quite sure they fully captured that. He says, yes, you're going to be able to do this. But listen to this, verse 40. But to sit at my right or my left, this is not mine to give, for it is for those for whom it has been prepared. And the Father is the one who will choose that. It is not yours. You follow me. You die for my sake. You live for me. The Father takes care of everything. One of the things in the Christian life for us to live in such a way that we live and lead and love like Christ is that we die to Him, for Him, and we just trust Him. Everything that happens after. We don't pick our future. We trust Him with our future. The unhesitating answer of the two probably indicates that they still didn't understand what was involved with being a disciple or living like Christ, and sometimes we miss the same. Their expectation is a glorious kingdom, obviously, from verse 37. Not necessarily agreeing to suffer or fully understanding that. But it is for those whom it has been prepared. Trust God and live life. We must surrender the whole matter of rewards and glory to a hidden purpose of God, and His purpose cannot be thwarted. What God chooses will be sufficient and most glorious. The righteous live their life in a way that glorifies Him, and trust God to determine what His pleasure will be. Think about Joseph in the Old Testament. Joseph had dreams about the future. His failure is not the dreams. His failure was boasting, perhaps boasting about that to all his brothers. What happens to Joseph? He tells his brothers, this is what my future entails, and this is your future. You're going to be down to me. It's going to be great. All right? A little boastful. Was he right that that was going to happen? Yes. And we don't know what, as a young man, 17-year-old Joseph, really was saying or what his motive was. But the vision was right. He would be put in a position of prominence. But it was God's way of doing it, not Joseph's. Well, the brothers obviously sell him into slavery. He goes to Egypt. If he didn't already have it, Joseph eventually learned humility and trust Holy God, in His sovereign way. Joseph had to die to self. Go to prison, be falsely accused and go to prison, live there and for many years not knowing what's going to happen. And when God opened the prison doors, allowed him to come out and basically interpret the dream for Pharaoh, then God rose him to prominence. Beautiful picture. And when his brothers eventually moved to Egypt to get food, and then they discovered it was Joseph, they were trembling a little bit. But grace was then extended. It wasn't a man who wielded power that wanted to destroy them and get revenge. Joseph had learned enough humility and grace and realized it was God's will, not Joseph's ambitions. And God protected his family. God had made a promise to Abraham that I would make you a generation upon generation of faithful people, people who would declare my name. Had the Israelites been extinguished because of the famine, we would have had them no more. But God had his method of bringing Joseph to Egypt to sustain the Jewish people. Live like Jesus is a call to die. I live like Jesus is a call to trust. And Joseph had to live in such a way where he could say, you meant this for evil, but God meant this for good. Jesus chapter 2. Listen to this verse. Psalm 75, verse 6 and 7 says, for not from the east, nor from the west, nor from the desert comes exaltation, but God is the judge. He puts down one and exalts another. Psalm 75, verse 6 and 7. In Mark chapter 10, verse 41, you'll see this now. Hearing this, the 10 began to feel indignant with James and John. Why would the other 10 start being a little upset with James and John on their question of Jesus? You think they were mad? He says, well, we want to die for you too. No, I'm not quite sure that's what they were thinking either. Yeah. All of them were upset going, are you trying to just self-promote? Are you trying to do something beyond what you ought to? I don't know if it was their chastisement about them being unspiritual, or they're just saying, hey, look, we want a chance at it also. We're selfish. Yeah, it's like Abraham Lincoln once said. Someone asked him what was wrong with his two sons when they were fighting. He says, well, the same thing's wrong with them that's wrong with the rest of the world. Buy three walnuts and both of them want two. Why do we fight? Because we want what we want when we want it. We need some sober thinking about dying. There are only two seats besides Jesus. All 12 of them wanted one of those. It makes for turmoil on teams, politics, in the office, and churches. Strife within families, because we always want the best position. Living like Jesus requires sober thinking, because it is a call to die and a call to trust. So Jesus then changes the conversation one more time, from their selfish thinking to sober thinking to servant thinking, calling them to himself. I think that's a great phrase. I don't want you to miss that. I don't know how it says it in your translation, but New American Standard says, calling them to himself. Is that not where our life in Christ begins? It's not calling them to a position, calling them to a certain place. It's calling them to himself. I'm the focus here, Jesus says. Your thinking has to start with me. Calling them to himself, Jesus said to them, you know that those who are recognized as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over you. Yeah, they've got position of influence and power. And their great men exercise authority over them. Verse 43, but it is not this way among you. The believers, your thinking must be different. Whoever wishes to become great among you shall be what? Your servant. You want positions of prominence? Die to self, trust me, and serve. You want to go the other route? Then go the way of the Gentiles. If you want to be great, you must be a servant. Whoever wishes to be first among you must be a slave of all. For even the Son of Man, the very God incarnate, did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. There's a shift of thinking here that they have to embrace, understand, and apply. Officials of the world love to exercise authority and have positions of prominence. They love to bark out orders and intimidate and threaten. This is not of those who live like Jesus. A little boy who's 15 minutes late getting home. He's in kindergarten, 15 minutes late getting home from school, which is only two blocks away. His mother asked him, Billy, why are you so late? He grunted, because Bobby's the new crossing guard at the school. And today we had to wait 10 minutes till a car came just so he could stop it and let us go across. You ever had a new manager that just felt like he needed to exercise authority? Mm-hmm. Have you ever worked for a boss who'd love to be in charge? You know, where it was all about their status and your submission to authority. And Jesus says, but it is not this way with you. If you're following me, you wish to be great. To live like Jesus, we must be countercultural in our thinking. Instead of lording it over people, as he suggests the Gentiles are doing, godly servants seek to serve others for their good. Instead of demanding attention, servants step out of the spotlight and look for ways to make others benefit, even from behind the scenes. Instead of making decisions based on image enhancement, servants' decisions are based on what is best for others and for the glory of God. Instead of demanding respect, one must live like Jesus by earning respect by how you walk, and talk, and care for others. Jesus demonstrated this thinking throughout all of chapter 10. And to conclude, I just want you to kind of scan through chapter 10 and mark. He starts with marriage. What does marriage have to do with the subject here about serving? Aha, you haven't been married very long if you don't understand that connection. The two shall become one flesh, he says. Your desire is to divorce. Why? Because you're always wanting the best instead of humbling yourself and serving each other. He goes on to the separation of children. He's saying, adults, you need to be like the children. Join with them. Live and trust like children and not push them away thinking you're better than children. Why not serve those children and bring them to Jesus? He talks about money and with the rich young ruler wanted position. He says, well, look, I've kept all of these things. Jesus says, all right, then depart with your money, since that seems to be your God. And he couldn't do it. He goes away sad. So marriage and maturity and money, you see here, these things, you need to humble yourself and serve. Even the first shall be last, and the last shall be first, as he addresses Peter in verse 28 through 31, with mobility wherever you go, with the impact. The way up is down, serving his influence, as we just discussed. And the last little section here, chapter 10, with mercy, people come to you, blind and needy. You seek to meet his needs. I'm sure at the end of chapter 10, the disciples were a little confused. Here's a man who was very wealthy, and you let him walk away, but then you let him, this blind man, he can contribute nothing. Come, follow. The lame man ends up following him. What a contrast. I think if I summarize just this section here, the two phrases that stuck out most to me was when they asked the question, in your glory, and failed to say, for your glory, and Jesus' ultimate response to them was in verse 42, calling them to himself. Our thinking must change from our glory and our desires to his glory and his desires. And just coming to him to be like Jesus, to live like Jesus, is to come to him. Our greatest privilege in living is that he calls us to himself, to be like him.